So like my favorite thing to do is like walk into any kind of experiential terrain, like it's a restaurant or whatever, and start looking in that place for inspiration to whatever problem you're trying to solve and draw those connections, because that's where a lot of the novel kind of ideation or possibility comes from to me. And it's just fun as well.
Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your host and fellow student. In this episode, I spoke with Christina Ducre. Christina is the founder of Labyrinth, a modern haven for spiritual growth. After experiencing a significant loss at a pivotal moment in her life, Christina decided to pivot her career to focus on spirituality, which ultimately gave way to the founding of Labyrinth. In this episode, she talks about her relationship with creativity throughout her life, how it has fueled her founder journey, and creativity's connection to spirituality. I hope you enjoy our episode. Welcome, Christina. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Jenna. I am really excited too. It's going to be fun.
First of all, I love that I have to mention that you're wearing a bright, bright colored shirt in honor of creativity showing up. I love it. So I would love to start with taking you back to your childhood and thinking about Christina, age 7, 8, 9. Mm-hmm. And as you think about yourself around that age, how was creativity coming out?
I love that. Well, for the purpose of answering this question, I think it's important that we name that little girl Stina, which was my childhood nickname and the name that I've adopted as an adult, because it kind of migrated from my family into like my closest relationships, even at work. And Stina to me connotes like my most creative, authentic self. So back in the day, as a little girl, I was kind of surrounded by creativity and then very much like in touch with that from as young of an age as I can remember. Both of my parents were deeply creative. My dad was an artist and a designer. My mom was an excellent chef and a business person who always ran her own companies. So it was a big part of my life to be surrounded by art and music and just sort of self-expression. And for me as a kid, that meant from a very young age, wanting to make things. So, and wanting to write and wanting to like express the way I saw the world through art. The things I remember most are like from a very young age, writing poetry and like sitting outside and sort of expressing the way I saw the world creatively. Like I've always loved playing with words. I've always kept journals and sketch pads to sort of reflect that sort of inner life that was going on. And then I've always been really interested in the future and like what's going to happen. So a lot of my earliest diaries include like, here's what I think is the future might be like, and like little sketches and almost like blueprints of stuff that I wanted to make and invent. So in many ways, you know, the seedlings of what I have become and the way, you know, my work and life has sort of shown up in these later years was present from those 7 or 8 year old times as well.
Wow. Yeah, definitely sounds like someone who winds up working in innovation and starting their own company.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so funny especially about writing about the future. Were there any like interesting predictions that you can remember?
I wish I had the page. I'll send a picture of it afterwards, but it was something like, in the future, people are going to be so lazy. Everything is going to be delivered to their door in an instant, and they're never going to have to go shopping anymore. Like one of these things where I'm like, it me, like my Amazon activity is out of control, but like, you know, very like curious. And this was, you know, I guess in the 90s at some point, so it wasn't like obvious, but I was like thinking about these things. And yeah, that has been a theme since very early on. I'll find the receipts for you because they're really funny just to look at and astonishingly accurate. It's like, what was I reading or thinking about? I don't know how that came across.
What about thinking in your childhood about spirituality too? Just kind of given this is where you wound up evolving. I'm curious, like thinking about you maybe around that age or just your childhood in general, what was kind of your relationship with spirituality?
I think it's a beautiful question to ask because to me, spirituality is this innate human need capacity. And it's intimately linked to me with the creative impulse, the need to sort of convey like the ineffable or the invisible things of life and like just try to like scrawl something down that captures it or put it on paper through like a sketch that you do. And so those early memories of sitting down to write for me are some of my earliest memories of spiritual awareness and spiritual curiosity and a real interest in like the mystery of life, whether that was an interest in other humans and what was going on in their interior worlds, or just being moved by nature and moved by art that I saw, and having this really reflective streak from a very young age that got expressed a lot of the time through these creative outlets. So when I look back at like the evidence of like the ways I've always been interested in spirituality, it's really intimately linked with everything I just mentioned about creativity. And if I can add one other little anecdote, there's research that shows that like spirituality is like one third inherited, like literally in your DNA. And then, you know, there's the whole nature versus nurture question. But we often learn just through the example of who we're around. And in my case, my sort of spiritual role model is my father, who's deeply artistic and like he lives in sort of a realm. He's very connected with nature. And my earliest memories of church and spirituality in that context weren't from like the rituals and the words and the teachings. It was from watching my father in the moments where church would become quiet and we were invited to pray. And I picked up on something in him just by watching him that he was connecting with. And I was like, I want some of that. It was way bigger than what was happening in this, you know, Episcopalian, like little white clapboard church in Connecticut. And I could tell that he was connecting with a deeper current of life and what was like visibly present all around us. And that impression is something I've carried with me throughout my life and still seek to connect with.
That's such an interesting observation and just spark of curiosity early on to see someone, to see like the model of religion organized, but then to see someone experiencing such a personal instance of spirituality.
Yeah, exactly. And just like kind of watching people in their flow state, you know, like watching my dad draw, like to me evokes not only his like creative talent, but like just his like ability to sort of tap into something else. So yeah, very related in my mind.
So we have the picture of Stina as a child, which I love. So I want to fast forward a little bit and talk about some of the early inklings of Labyrinth. So you've shared on LinkedIn and elsewhere about your experience of going through a dark night of the soul and how that really prompted your dedication to pivot your career really and focus on spirituality. So I would love if you would share a little bit about that story and how that came about.
Yeah. So thanks for teeing this up so nicely, because the backdrop is having this sort of spiritual awareness. And then in my late 20s, at sort of like, you know, one of the early peaks of life and adulthood, I had, you know, gotten married. I had just had my first child and walked over that threshold into motherhood, which is like a transformational experience in and of itself. And those first moments of holding your baby after birth are so moving, and you really do feel connected with it all. It's one of those almost cliched spiritual moments. But what happened in the months afterwards, in the 18-month period that followed my first child being born, was my mom getting diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and passing away within 4 months. During that time, I was her caregiver and was at her bedside as she died. And then very quickly became pregnant with my daughter, and she was born, you know, 9 months after my mom passed. So the way I would describe this moment is like being the circle of life just sort of suffocating me like a snake or something like that, and being forced to hold both the beginning, the birthing process, and also like death, and those things coming so close into contact in a way that was really uncomfortable. And I tried to move myself through using tools that reflected the symptoms I had, which is like depression and post-traumatic stress from all the time in the hospitals and grappling with all of this. And as I continued to kind of struggle through that and not make progress and feel that a lot of life was kind of gray and bland and meaningless, I started to recognize that I was solving for the wrong problem. And it wasn't just purely this mental and emotional distress I was feeling that I needed to solve for. It was the deeper sort of spiritual and existential questions that we will all face in these chapters that bring life down to the studs and force us to kind of question everything. And I really see that as like a pervasive challenge and the way that we view our health and how we cater to it. And that's what I feel really committed to solving and kind of helping other people through at this stage.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. And so, you know, as you were going through that, what were some of the things that you found about, you know, your either journey with therapy or mental health that you started to notice there wasn't maybe something out there that was quite appropriate for the way that you were going through it?
I tried many, many things. Interestingly, like after that disruption, one of the first things that happened to me was even as I was struggling, like I was still like very high functioning and going back to work after those multiple leaves really like reignited my sense of what my time was worth and what my purpose was. And so one of the first stops on my journey was career coaching, which I actually think is a classic step that many people take. And the job search is often a mask for a soul search. And it's just like, how long do you stay in it and get into it? So it really was about like, what am I creating in this world? What's, you know, what's worth doing with my time? And that was certainly helpful. I went through the typical like rigmarole that this point is just like so overstated about how hard it is to find a therapist and tried to get myself like some traditional therapy. But the things that really helped, and it took me a while to sort of guide myself into like, oh, here's what's actually working and like what these things have in common, were approaches that got me out of my head and into my body, into other ways of knowing and exploring and sort of healing myself. So while I was in the experience of caring for my mom, the one thing that brought me true like reprieve was an aerial yoga class I would go to. The act of literally hanging upside down, which is a beautiful metaphor to me of like brain comes last, body comes first, like a total inverse, really helped me change my relationship to self in those moments in a way that was really healing. And then, you know, some of the other tools that I ended up trying were like acupuncture and the spiritual conversations alongside of that, some different kind of coaching protocols that were more meditative and didn't like require as rational of an engagement that I could intellectualize my way through. So there were many things I started to realize. And then I came to recognize these as like, you know, not just addressing my mental and emotional needs, but those deeper spiritual needs.
Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting because it's, I think so often we look to just one solution, therapy or, you know, medicine. And it's so powerful to be able to cultivate like different experiences that to come together to kind of feed your soul.
100%. And to make the connection to creativity and generativity, as I researched this question with other people and asked like in a survey and in countless interviews, maybe 200 people over the course of a couple of months, how have you navigated your personal growth in these moments or dark nights of the soul? The consistent theme across people who are really fulfilled and who maybe faced like incredible hardship, but had turned that into like growth and self-realization and, you know, career paths that really reflected who they were and what their gifts were, all the goodness that we all want, they all had this highly creative constellation of practices, people, and experiences that they had brought around themselves. And it takes a lot of things to do that. It takes persistence and kissing lots of frogs, but it also takes like a real creative stance around kind of designing your own journey and having agency and authorship over the retelling or exploration of your story through lots of different mediums, you know? So that's what I'm obsessed with. And what ends up happening in the real world is like people have to kind of force things that don't want to talk to each other into a dialogue around themselves, which is just like too much work. And so, yeah, like Labyrinth really exists to like kind of give people access to that very creative, multifaceted approach to growing and healing without as much friction.
Well, and it's, I think what's also just so, you know, the way I think about it is it's an expression of yourself, right? It's like, it's so hard to describe who we are in words, right? It's almost impossible. And so I often think about creativity as this like ability to, or this attempt to try to share, hey, this is a part of me in this song, in this writing, in this poem, in this artwork. And I think what's so incredible about you is that you have created a company that is really an expression of you and the journey that you've gone through.
I love what you're saying so much. And it's like one of the things that's like, I'll never stop being moved by that idea. Like, to me, the best art, and let's like use the term art really broadly, I think our life is a form of art. Like, you know, those people where you're like, you walk into their home and you're just like, oh man, like this is like such a pure, compared with, for example, if you look on a Zillow listing, everything's kind of gray. There's like perfectly like generic piece of art over the couch kind of thing. That compared with a world that reflects something about that person's inside is endlessly moving. And then like music and paintings and these other creative artifacts do that so beautifully. And that for me is just like a really basic human impulse. And it doesn't necessarily relate to like talent or like craft necessarily. It's just like our need to be known and seen and to express that in, and yeah, company making. Like, I do view myself as like a conduit for something kind of coming through me, and like it picks up who I am and what I care about. That's my lens or the way I can shape this thing to bring it into the world. But I think you're totally right. That is kind of exactly what it's about.
I mean, I think the other thing too is like, I think you're a David White fan as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a quote that he has about hiding. It's either shyness or hiding. And he says like the things that are most deeply felt within you have to start hidden, right? And it takes you time to kind of come out of that and share. And so I'm curious, like in the context of that, given what you were going through, like what was it like to finally take the step to share publicly and to start to actually dedicate, like create this company and share it with the world?
I just like, yeah, first want to address that like hidden comment. It's really interesting how we can be like hidden even from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's creative output that is for others. But if you think about creative output and just like a way to sort of process what you're going through. So for example, journaling or expressive writing or morning pages, you know, that a lot of people are familiar with. It's really interesting to explore like, what am I allowing myself to say just to myself? And so, and like, how intimate am I with like my own thoughts and feelings, my own impulses for creation, for saying what I really feel is true, for expressing those parts of me that are kind of hidden? My process of becoming an entrepreneur, I think, started like literally in kind of writing to myself and gradually admitting that I wanted to lead. I wanted and believed that I had something to offer. And it wasn't like hyping myself up, but just simply it becoming like inevitable. Those parts started to like really eke out onto the page. And like the first person I said it to was myself in those like intimate moments of reflection and writing. And then over the last year, I've been working with a team and we've been mainly focused on like saying it to ourselves, having it make sense to our own inner coherence. And then it got to a point where enough of that had eked out where it kind of feels natural now to share it more with the world. That doesn't mean we have all the answers, but now that like the kind of mystery we've been trying to unfurl is a little bit less hidden just to us, I'm using like the team as basically another version of the interiority of the self. It kind of makes a lot of sense, more sense to share that externally. It's like integrity, right? Like sameness on the inside as you are on the outside. Like once I got more clear about my own desires and actually was able to like admit them in louder than a whisper voice, that started to reflect kind of naturally on the outside. Doesn't mean it's like not hard. Then there's like a million types of limiting beliefs and insecurities that come up. But I do find that process of like really expressing yourself starts with like first doing it to yourself, like being able to have that self intimacy and like kind of realness on the inside.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a big part of the creative process, right? Because if you're creating something that's truly in touch with who you are, it goes through that period of wanting to just get comfortable with yourself first and then before you can actually share with others.
Yeah, totally. It's really beautiful to witness actually. And like, I live for like those moments of truth just within the self, because those often like are the precursor to like something really beautiful coming out that then gets to include others or influence others or, you know, move them in some way.
Well, so let's talk about Labyrinth. I would love to kind of hear a little bit about what the company is, how you describe it, what the experience is like for those listening.
Sure. So Labyrinth is a modern haven for spiritual development and personal growth. And our approach is to bring that multifaceted constellation of support around people in these kind of sacred transition moments. So recognizing that there's not one way to solve these types of challenges of the heart and mind. Actually, we have many centers of intelligence and ways of knowing. We have this profound kind of spiritual capacity that can be such an amazing source of authenticity and healing. And if all you're doing is like talking about your challenges in a therapy or coaching context, you might get somewhere. Words are really important, but you're likely to plateau in matters that are really complex, that defy rational or logical thinking. And that sort of deductive approach that we love to take as like, you know, problem solvers and like, I can brain my way through this. So what we've done is really gather practitioners and resources and the modalities that are most impactful and credible and directly nurture spiritual capacity and like the kind of key facets of that. We name those facets emergence, embodiment, essence, and expression. And the idea with that is all these different ways you can sort of tap into and grow that sort of core self or essential self, which is often what we need most when we're facing a time where all the external stuff, our external identities have fallen away and we really need to create something new. It's like going back to the source material and recreating from there.
Completely agree with what you said. I think so many of us are stuck in the intellectualizing and don't get the opportunity to necessarily try some of these other modalities that we wouldn't otherwise have exposure to or be able to find ourselves. You know, you'd have to kind of go through a process of trying so many different things. So it's such an incredible experience that you bring them all together. So one of my questions is, the spiritual journey is such a personal and lonely journey, right? But I think one of the things that's so interesting about what you're doing at Labyrinth is creating these like cohorts that people go through and have a sense of community. So what has that been like and how do you see that impacting a person's spiritual journey?
That's such a beautiful thing to call out. So if I think about like why this like, you know, mission is important, like the thing we want to reawaken in the world is spiritual health and shared humanity. To me, having a visceral, direct experience of shared humanity is medicine. And what I mean by that is the moment in any kind of communal or relational context where you get beneath the surface and your essence is connecting naturally with someone else's. Those are the moments where you're looking at someone who maybe has nothing in common with you at the surface. And their lived experience, their wisdom, their truth unlocks something that you've been struggling with. And in that moment, you're like, oh my God, like that is just what I needed to hear. And like you're moved forward through that connectivity, through that person's gift of their own lived experience. And for a long time now, I've been obsessed with the experiences that bring people together in that type of way. You know, I led member experience at Chief and designed their group coaching platform. I'm a YPO forum moderator. Like I'm really drawn to like, how do you have those moments of shared humanity? Not by accident. I think we could all relay a time where it's like, oh my God, that stranger totally, you know, changed my life or whatever. But how do you do that on purpose? And how does that inform a very individualized journey of spiritual growth? The way we look at it is that, you know, everything that we do isn't there to like give you different forms of expertise and advice, but rather to foreground your own wisdom and like sort of the inner teacher's voice, like who this core self is and how they would lead life if they were in charge. And yes, you can get in touch with that on your own, but you will come to know that part of yourself so much faster if you're doing it in relationship to others and you're having that shared humanity experience. that other people are so crucial to helping you discern and amplify that inner voice. And the interplay of like our kind of 12-week journey, which is the product experience we've launched with and have been developing for the last year, is individual experiences where you go deep on your own questions and needs, complemented by these really beautiful conversations with your peers where you get to compare notes, but then also really discern what you're like and what your path is relative to these others and potentially be really moved forward by someone else's share even more than, you know, what your own lived experience would permit. So it's a really special interplay. And like whether, I mean, to me, we're just trying to recreate what people stumble into when they're effective. But if you're on a path right now and you're doing it totally alone, find those contexts where you can have that human connection or just find one friend, one companion to really witness you and help you do that discernment process because it's just, it's so important.
Yeah. It's like, I feel like we always forget. It's like when you think about your health, it's like sleep, exercise, nutrition, but we always forget that human connection is fundamentally necessary for your health. And you know, I think that ability to continuously remind people by, and also remind people that you're not the only one going through this. It can be a lonely journey together.
100%. And actually, like the idea of, for example, or the practice of self-compassion, the researcher Kristen Neff did this work to be like, what actually is it? What are the components? The three components are, it doesn't start with being like, may I be kind to myself? May I be well? Actually, it starts with, I am suffering, or this freaking sucks, or I am totally stuck and I don't know how I'm going to get through. Acknowledging your suffering, and then crucially recognizing all beings suffer, connecting to that shared humanity, and then may I be well, may I be kind to myself, whatever. And that second piece of connecting to shared humanity is, it's ideally like if you've had that experience and you can really call upon it in those moments, you can really like administer that practice so much more powerfully to like get yourself through those really challenging moments where that's kind of all you have.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. I'm curious what it was like for you. You're coming into this maybe mental health space is perhaps where Labyrinth might be classified as kind of an industry outsider. You know, you're not a therapist. What was it like for you to have that, you know, beginner's mind, and how important was that in this process?
Yeah. So my career, you know, tagline could be like creativity / making new things as a discipline, whether it was in kind of brand design and strategy at Bridgewater in my earliest days, or innovation strategy and design consulting at Fahrenheit, you know, working for all different companies who wanted to make new things and bring them to the world, to like getting into early stage venture and actually building stuff. My discipline, the thing I bring to Labyrinth, yeah, is the lifelong appreciation and sensitivity to like the actual subject matter, but moreover, the lens of experience design and creativity as a practice, and the healthy appreciation for, you know, new ideas and novel solutions coming at the intersection of maybe things that haven't typically gone together. So, you know, in the case of Labyrinth, it really came from being like, okay, it's not about like optimizing therapy or coaching or this woo-woo world. It's about a missing archetype in between all of those characters. And how would you design towards that? And so everything we do is definitely informed by best practice and ethical approaches and the modalities and expertise that our team brings. But it all comes through this lens of like experience design, like in the discipline of innovation, innovating up from like deeply held consumer insights, or like what people are actually going through and what their needs are, and kind of building from that first principle standpoint. And I think that's a real advantage in this space, where a lot of the innovation has been around like the channel and like how, you know, directories to make it easier to find someone or match with them. And I'm like more interested in like, what is the actual quality of this experience? And is it answering the problem that I think a vast majority of people have? Like, you know, no amount of changing the plumbing around something is going to necessarily fix like the underlying challenge. So that for me is an edge. We'll see where it leads us, but yeah.
No, I love that. And it's like in the creative art world, there's the concept great artists steal, right? You're like, no idea is new. You're starting with a chord progression. You're starting with lyric, whatever. And then in the innovation world, like you mentioned, like combinatory play, like what two ideas can we put together? And like, yeah. And so I love that, because those who are ingrained in the industry are often, you know, subject to the frameworks that exist. So it takes sometimes someone to come in fresh and, you know, not be so confined to those frameworks.
Yes. Coming in fresh. And like what you just said about, you know, like there's this like corny thing that people say about creativity, which is like, well, Picasso could break the rules because he knew all of them. He was a master, you know? It's kind of true. Like being aware of the paradigm in which you're operating. Mm-hmm. Whether that's inside of yourself and getting that out of the way so that you can have that moment of true creativity, like the paradigm is often what keeps those parts hidden, right, in us, or keeps those solutions, those really new ideas hidden from our view. It's like blind spots around the assumptions that we don't even, or biases we don't even realize that we're carrying. So for me, creativity as a practice is a lot about observing from those different altitudes and like ways of looking at the problem and not just being so enmeshed with the way it is, because then you're only going to produce variations on the way it is. So I get really interested in like, oh, if I just distill this down to like its bones, like what are the bones and, you know, do those make sense? And then I think the other thing that's really interesting is like, okay, maybe you can't get out of the paradigm of your own industry. You're too enmeshed, but something we can all do is the forced practice of like taking analogs from other spaces or contexts and doing the practice of like, how does this apply? So like my favorite thing to do is like walk into any kind of experiential terrain, like it's a restaurant or whatever, and start looking in that place for inspiration to whatever problem you're trying to solve and draw those connections, because that's where a lot of the novel kind of ideation or possibility comes from to me. And it's just fun as well.
It's so fun. It's so fun. You're bringing me back to my innovation lab days. I think what's also important, we're talking about, you know, idea generation and where ideas come from and how you put them together. I think another key part of this is also keeping your mind present and open to the fact that these ideas are out there and not converging on the problem too quickly, where you're no longer looking for potential ideas, right?
100%. That for me is where the like creativity and spirituality really intersect, in the sense that sometimes you're like starting out and you're just like making something, you have to make it. But when it's like truly generative, meaning it's like kind of bubbling up from inside of you, there's this like very tenuous like flow of insight or instinct or hunches that you can either be totally shut down to, or you can really make a practice of listening to and acknowledging when they occur and being like, oh my God, like that little whisper of an idea or a flash of, ooh, maybe that's a thing. Those are so precious. And actually stopping to like capture those and keeping that channel. I almost, when you were talking, almost viewed, you know, like us as like antennae for it, you know, like really keeping those channels of insight open in whatever it is we're doing, or if we want to be engaged in like a creative life, it's like listening to our impulses about like what feels right to us, or if we want to do it on a project, it's like, what's my hunch for this? And like writing those down. I used to do that at the beginning of innovation projects, even from the first time I heard about the client, I'd write down my little harebrained ideas. And sometimes even after all the strategy work and consumer research and blah, 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 those ideas would still be worthwhile, you know, and you could come back to them and then really find out like why that instinct was good or whatever. So definitely want to be paying attention to your hunches.
Yeah, I love that. It's a good tip. And it's a good like also reason to be working on presence and awareness. And
yeah, like being able to be an observer of like your own thoughts and awareness, because like you want to be able to mediate and have choice over what gets picked out versus like some of those like little timid creative thoughts, I feel like very easily get bullied out by your rational brain.
So true.
Which is like, you don't make any sense. Like, go away. And it's like, you get to mediate and be like, actually, chill, bro. Like, we're just trying to create right now. Like, can she just have that weird idea right now? That's fine. Let's run with it.
That's really funny. Wait, okay. I want to go deeper into that. There's this concept that comes up a lot on this podcast is the balance between creativity and practicality. And, you know, maybe like to some extent that critic can sometimes be ingrained in the practicality. So I'm curious, like in your inner world, how those two parts relate to each other and how you've, you know, maybe gotten them to whatever their current relationship is.
There's like two kind of answers to this. There's recognizing that there's a time and place for different types of work and exploration. And for me, you know, the whole constraints breed creativity thing is very true, at least in my experience. Like I really love something to react to, even if it's just the world around me, you know? And for me, that's recognizing that if you can tell that practical part of yourself, listen, I'm in diverge mode. The cone wants to open as far as it can to catch whatever harebrained things I can come up with, to really try, like diverge mode. And there's all types of practices, whatever medium you're talking about, for divergent or very open-ended, playful exploration that's not supposed to be practical. And yet, the practical thing is to be like, I'm giving that a time and a place. You know, I'm not going to do this all day long. That starts to be really not only impractical, but just annoying, right? If you ever want to make anything, it's annoying to like keep having like harebrained ideas when you're then trying to be in that mode. And then, so you pay that respect by naming that process in yourself, recognizing where you're at, or if you're leading a team or a conversation, saying, here's where we're at, this is what's okay and how we're going to be together. Just the framing tends to do wonders. And then there's the convergent side, which is like, okay, we are now shifting gears to be practical. And even making sure that practical really means like curiosity and questioning as opposed to just shutting down without really knowing and investigating. Often the things that we think are possible or probable or whatever, we're kind of wrong about because we haven't done the work to investigate them. So both sides need to be tempered in their relative strengths and weaknesses. And I'm really obsessed with like framing the conversation if it's with other people to be like, here's what we're trying to do. And that has like such a magical effect because people then feel really free. Like the most practical person in the room is kind of like, wait, you mean I get to be fun? I get to write any post-it I want? That's fun. And so they might need a nudge or two, but you know.
Yeah. No, that's a really great way of kind of describing the balance and tempering the strengths and weaknesses of both and not seeing them in conflict. Yeah.
And there's the more meditative piece that we were talking about, which is just like, you should be aware that if you're trying to get funky, weird, let magical creative thoughts flow through you, the best ones are really not going to make sense when you first have them. They're going to be like a dream, which is like, that was cool, but like, what the heck just happened? And you just have to know, like, the inside part of you that is not going to like that is the part that's like, this needs to make sense. And like, that's dumb or whatever your version of that. Some of us are judgy. Some of us are critical. Some of us are worried about perfection and it being good enough, whatever the case may be. Like that part is for sure going to try and come to the party when you're trying to be creative. So you just got to like, be like, thanks so much for being here. I've got this. We're totally fine. We can entertain these ideas. We're safe.
So I'm curious in your founder journey, like what has been some of the biggest learnings?
The only thing that like truly keeps me going is recognizing that the whole thing is a learning journey. I try to frame every aspect of this process as learning because I find telling myself that over and over and over again consistently lets me like get the thing out that's half-baked or have the hard conversation that I've never had to have before or figure out, you know, step up and figure out some systems thing that I, you know, like even on the practical side, just being like, you know what, I'm here to learn. That's it. I might not be good enough or ready enough to do this particular aspect of the job, but like I'm learning and I'm going to try to like be really conscious of that process. Within that, some of the specific learnings or aha moments have come from really around how my creative process was working. Like at the end of the day, like a company needs to like be out there in the world and like ideally like having paying customers, right? And where I came from was wanting things to make so much sense and needing to have them all visualized. And at a certain point and with some really potent conversations at the right time, I came to see like it's really just about the next most logical step good enough and done is better, so much better than perfect. It's about like velocity to dollar one or whatever the smallest increment of the thing is that you're trying to do. It's velocity to podcast episode one, that kind of thing, versus like getting stuck in the bigness of what you're trying to bring out in the world. And so that's been a really big lesson. And it's not just a cognitive one. It's one I've really begun to embody. And it's actually, I can feel the shift in me. Like instead of feeling totally blocked as I'm trying to like maybe write something or like publish something to clients, I've begun to notice it change to like more of an excited energy of like, I know that what I need to do right now is just hit send and go. So that's one of the big lessons I would say is like, you know, get out of your own way, Christina. Like you're going to learn at the end of the day. So just do it.
Yeah, that is, I mean, that's such a huge one with any part of the creative process and really just being human, right? Like I love the way you described like the bigness of it versus just taking one step. It's like that applies to creative projects. It applies to company building. It applies to living your life. What surprised you maybe about people's spiritual journeys? Like as you've kind of seen a couple people or a couple cohorts now go through this, anything that, you know, you've changed your assumptions about or hypotheses?
So one thing that's helpful in a creative process is like actually forming assumptions and hypotheses. If you want to learn and actually know what you've learned, it really helps to be like, this is what I think. And then to compare reality with what you thought and to be like, what did I learn? So because from a very early on time, I was like, this is a learning journey. So I'm going to frame it like that. There are a couple distinct things that stand out from, you know, the 50 plus clients that we've like walked alongside for this like 3 month, you know, intensive journey. It's pretty cool. One of the big ones was this assumption I had in the early kind of formation stage of Labyrinth, or actually just the collection of insights that became Labyrinth, I should say, was this idea that people were really seeking credibility and a way to understand that the thing that they were doing was sound somehow, that they needed to have that common sense satisfied in order to have a transformational experience. The reason I thought that was important is because if you look in the world past like, you know, licensed therapy, where there's like some widely agreed upon like source of legitimacy, and you get into the world of coaching or healers or whatever type of practitioners, you very quickly lose contact with any consistent form of legitimacy or credibility. And that can be very difficult to navigate. And a lot of people reported feeling so nervous about like kind of being led astray and felt that as a real risk in their process of self-exploration. So I thought it was going to be a lot about credibility. What we learned in running 400 sessions with people over the last year, and interestingly, clients only meet with each guide one time, so we really have one time to nail it, is that consistently it's the guides, not the guides' credibility, that's important. It's their ability to create this sense of familiarity and emergence in the moment that far outweighs like their resume or whatever. We have practitioners that have been really carefully vetted and bring like really rich, credible experience, but that didn't always translate into the most impactful session for a client. It's actually this quality of presence and how much that they created this sense of like, I really know you and I'm really here with you in the here and now. And therefore, what we're now designing for is a lot more of like, okay, like how do we find that in the people that we recruit? How do we train towards it? How do we make moments in the journey that like naturally elicit that? And yeah, that was like a very big aha moment and probably saved us a lot of time also, like, I don't know, working on things that would be all about like legitimacy when it really just needs to be about human contact.
Yeah, that is really interesting and also an interesting like quality to screen for.
It is. And yeah, if you think about, you know, the people that you work with or like any human responsible for delivering some kind of experience or facilitating one, I think about it kind of like hardware and software. Like on the hardware side, they're going to have certain values, capabilities, life experiences that like are just sort of naturally a part of them, that like would be really hard to train or change meaningfully. And then the software is things like what frameworks are they informed by and who did they train with? You know, what modalities do they work in? And those are almost like protocols that they employ in their work. And the balance between like where those things actually make an impact has been really interesting to see play out.
Well, let's see. We're coming up towards the end a little bit. I want to ask you, I'll ask you a question just about, you know, as you think about your views of creativity, how have your beliefs and views of creativity changed from that back to that young 7-year-old Stina to now Stina?
It's interesting. I've never reflected on that in that way. It's a good question. The thing that kind of like flashed through me was mistaking creativity at a younger age for like output and talent and quality and being maybe a little caught up in that. Like, I wish that at that age where I had like more free access, you know, without the crust of life experience and challenge, where I had free access to like more of essence, that I would have played even more. And it's funny, like as an adult, I feel like the things I've learned and the ways I've experienced creativity, like I now feel a lot more free and like it's a practice to play. It's a practice to let myself be weird when I need to be weird and to be practical when I need to be practical. And I think in younger years, I didn't have the presence to sort of protect myself from that bully judge or person who is like, that's not good enough, or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
I don't know. It's something in that. Like, actually, like it's been a center point of like every professional choice I've made, the people I surround myself with, who I consider to be a mentor, like it's really become central to my life in a way that maybe I took it a little bit for granted and let it just sort of float along at a younger age. But now it's really, really important to me. So
yeah, no, I love that. Well, and it's so inspirational to see you and just to see, I think, as we talked about, right, like someone that has gone through so much and gotten in touch with like what's truly deeply in your soul and then sharing it so publicly and giving it, you know, having it be an experience for others to go through as well. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you, Jenna. Thank you for what you're doing. I love that you're creating this conversation. I'm so happy I get to be a part of it. It serves, I think, both of our goals. Like, at the end of the day, if more humans could have some relationship to this really vital part of what it means to be alive, the world would be better. And it's not just for like the artists and the musicians. It's for like literally everyone.
Everyone. Yeah.
So I'm totally with you, and I'm really in awe of like what you've created, and so happy to be a part of it.
Thank you so much. Likewise. If people want to go through the labyrinth experience, what is the next step? Who is the right type of person, and what should they do?
So the right type of person is navigating a crossroads in their life. One of these moments where like literally they might be choosing a path to take, or a crossroads in terms of the tension between grief and joy, or birth and death, or fear and creativity. And it's in those intersection points where it's not going to be clear what answer we need to choose, and where I think the resource of your core self or the spiritual capacity is most impactful and beneficial. And we make that experience and the practice of connecting with that and bring it to bear really delightful and life-changing for many, many people. So the way you can find out more is obviously going to our website and then considering our sort of 12-week intensive, which we're going to be doing one final time in 2024, starting in mid to late September. And for that process, we're curating and kind of vetting a small number of clients, and that includes a sort of free reflection session with me, where we practice getting in touch with your core self around something that you're struggling with or want to explore, so you can see for yourself what that's like, and then frame, you know, how that opportunity might be able to support you. So I encourage folks to reach out to me if they'd like to set one of those calls up and learn more.
Awesome. Well, Christina, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a delight, and I've really appreciated sharing the space with you.
Thank you, Jenna.
I hope you enjoyed the episode with Christina Ducre. Labyrinth is currently open for its fall cohort starting in September. To get more information about the experience, go to labyrinth.com and book a discovery call, or learn more on the website. Thanks for listening.